Is this on? Are you just being very quiet, or is this really on? It's really on. Well, good evening. I'm Jane Wales, CEO of the World Affairs Council, and I want to welcome you to this Rich and Judith Guggenheim event, speaker series, with former President Fox. I want to thank the Langendorf Foundation for creating this series in Rich and Judith's name and see where Rich is. There's Rich, and no Judith. Just Rich. So we'll give our love to Judith, and thank you for your leadership, both at the council and with the community more broadly. Just a word about the next Guggenheim speaker will be the Foreign Minister of Poland, Mr. Sikorski, and that will be on August the 5th. So I hope that we see you again then before before the summer is done. This evening and all of our Guggenheim series is always taped for radio broadcast for KQED, so I want to ask you to turn off your cell phones, if you would, so that we won't be listening to them or listening to them even vibrate, because that really does affect the recording, and it will be uplifted then on for National Public Radio for broadcast across the country. We will be taking some question cards, but we only have an hour tonight, and so we'll be kind of squeezing things in as best we can. I've never heard such musical cell phones as we have tonight. If you wonder why I'm stalling, it's for the music to end. Is the music now over? It's over. Okay, it's my pleasure to welcome our guest, President Vicente Fox. He was president of Mexico from 2000 to 2006. His term of office, as you know, marked the end of 71 years of pre-rule, of single-party rule. He worked originally as a farmer, then as an executive for Coca-Cola, and at one point just decided it was time for a new kind of leadership and for Mexico, and he ran for public office, ultimately, for the presidency. He joined the National Action Party. It's called PAN, and he initially ran for the National Chamber of Deputies before running for president, when he succeeded Ernesto Zedillo in that spot. His focus was on working to improve trade relations, on quelling the turmoil that existed in Chiapas, and on reducing corruption, crime, and drug trafficking. And so we will talk about all of those issues with President Fox. So join me in welcoming him. By asking you about a very tough issue, and that's the issue of drug trafficking and what it has done. Secretary Clinton traveled to Mexico in March, and during her trip, in her remarks, she took some responsibility for the United States for this problem, noting our role as the demand side of the problem of the consumers of the illicit drugs, but also as the providers of the weapons. Can you say something about how her remarks were received in Mexico?
Okay. Well, thank you first for the invitation, and thank all of you for your presence here. The idea is to have a dialogue, so I hope we get many questions and we touch upon the issues that are important to you, because maybe the best part of politics is listening and learning, and that's what I expect to do today here with you. And now coming to your question, well, very first, congratulations to Hillary Clinton for the outstanding campaign and for the outstanding responsibility she's got today. And congratulations to all of you because of that exceptional democratic process of electing your leader in this nation. You know, one wonders after 200 years of democracy if it will still be so powerful in renewing hope, in renewing motivation, and in committing citizens to participate in that democracy. So congratulations to each and all of you for that. It was a great example for the rest of the world. And we renewed our faith in democracy in places like Latin America. We're just beginning. We're very young, recent democracies. So Hillary was most welcome to Mexico, because we don't forget that outstanding decision that her husband took when Mexico was facing one of these mammoth crises back in 1994, where we all Mexicans lost half of our patrimony in one night. A mammoth devaluation, a sudden increase of interest rates, inflation, like we used to do every other year. We became experts on crisis. That's why the actual crisis doesn't frighten us in Latin America. So she was very welcome because President Clinton put together a loan of $50 billion U.S. dollars to rescue the situation in Mexico. And it's surprising that 2 years after, Mexico was paying back the whole of the $50 billion. And it's incredible how the economy came back with such a strength. And basically it's that we humans have a great capacity that many times we don't discover even within ourselves. So she was very welcome and more welcome with her comments. This issue of drugs, it's been part of the, let's say, the bad or sad part of our relationship between Mexico and United States. And it's always been United States demanding Mexico to stop the transit or the traffic of drugs to the U.S. market. And it never had been evaluated as a joint responsibility, because the market is here. The consumer drug market is here in the United States. And so that makes same as responsible this nation as it is the case of Mexico or Colombia or Venezuela, Bolivia today, producing nations of drugs. So finally, the issue was understood in the sense that is part of our partnership and it's a joint responsibility. Because if it were not for the market here, we would not be having the killings, the 25, 30 killings every day in Mexico today. And the question is, what happens with the drug once it crosses the border? Who moves it to San Francisco, to the Bay Area, to Chicago, to Seattle, to New York, to Washington to be consumed? Where's a government in the world that takes the ethical decision like Presidente Calderón has taken? He has committed to stop the flow of drugs, to cut the supply of drugs to kids and to the market. I think it's a very courageous decision. I don't even see one leader in the world today that has taken such a decision. Because, yes, there is law here, there is the DEA or whatever, so many institutions, but the drug circulates, and the drug reaches our sons and the kids everywhere. So finally, after insisting long, it's understood today that we have to work together, or we will never win that battle. And this was the message that Hillary brought to Mexico. And not only the message, because messages we have listened to too many, especially when candidates are campaigning, we hear messages and messages and promises and promises and commitments and commitments. And then later on, we forget. I include myself on that. And so it's not only words. It's an amount of money has been approved to be transferred to Mexico to work, keep on working. But still, why should only Mexico be working? Why should we be paying the price of blood and the price of those killings every day? And what happened is very sad, let me tell you, because time ago, 25, 30 years ago, drug was produced in Colombia, Venezuela, Bolivia, and shipped and transferred to the U.S. market through Mexico. We were not producing drugs. We were not consuming drugs. And all of a sudden, Mexicans got it smart. They saw business in drugs, so they started producing drugs in Mexico. But it's after they saw that distributing would not give them the profits that they would get from producing. So we became a drug-producing nation. And while we've been successful in trying to refrain drugs from crossing the border, then the cartels now are promoting the sale of drugs in Mexico. And so all of a sudden now we have become a market, a consumption market for drugs. And this changed the whole paradigm. One thing is working a strategy to try to cut the transit of drugs coming from the south to the U.S. market, and the other one is refraining the distribution, the supply of drugs in the Mexican markets. And so what we have now is a war among cartels in Mexico. Big war, believe me, it's violent. And so, I mean, we are working, President Calderon's working hard in trying to win this war. It's not easy. It's been 3 years now, and it doesn't seem to have an end.
And what is the source of their armaments? How heavily armed are they? Are there limits to their access to arms?
Okay. This huge market here generates billions of U.S. dollars, literally billions of U.S. dollars. Where does that money go? Part, the great part of it, back to Mexico to bribe government officials, to bribe police corps, or goes back to the buying of weapons and guns here in this market. Because in Mexico, we don't produce arms, and we don't sell arms. It's totally forbidden.
So this is along our southern border, the gun stores along those borders? Is that the source of submachine guns?
They buy the guns here, no doubt, the cartels. Mm-hmm. And they bring them down. They smuggle them into Mexico. And they are very powerful cartels today, pretty well armed with very modern arms, including grenades today.
And has President Calderon spoken to our government about limiting access to arms? And did you, when you were president, did you press on that question?
Yes, of course. And I should say here, because some question, well, where was Vicente Fox when all of this was happening? And I think that in life, maybe we have only two specific times where there's an event, a black and white event, which is when you are born and when you die. The rest is processes. And in my term, we did invest a lot of money, time, and talent working against crime, cartels, and drug consumption. We created many new institutions in my term, but at the end, it was not enough. So President Calderon decides to bring in the army to fight the cartels and the drug traffickers. So he's using our last resort, all the power of the state in front of the cartels, and that's what is going on today. So this war is going to be won by the state in Mexico, and more so if we work together. Because at the very end, we have to reduce consumption. And at the very end, we should question ourselves, who is responsible for drug consumption? It's not the state. It's not government. It's we. It's we that are here. It's our kids. It's education that we have to work to reduce consumption. And maybe think about legalizing drugs. And maybe people just get scared when one mentions that. But that has been done. It was done here in the States, in Chicago, last century, the prohibition of alcohol, until the prohibition was ended. Then peace came back to Chicago and the area. And on the other side, when we see countries that have taken the step forward in taking that decision in Europe, the consumer market stays about the same. When you legalize, it's not a big increase in drug consumption. So at the very end, the responsibility is on the demand side that we have to work much more than what we're doing up to now.
What is the effect on the Mexican economy of this lack of security, of this instability that is associated with drug trafficking, associated with the cartels?
Yeah. Well, it was not significant. Even until the end of my term, it was not affecting the economy. It was not affecting the flow of programs, government investment. It was not affecting the development of the nation, the increase in human capital and else. But today, it has become so violent, and it's everywhere in media. And so today it's affecting tourism. It's affecting the image of Mexico. I'm sure it's affecting the boards where decisions are being made to invest. It's been affecting Mexican families because now we see a lot of entrepreneurs, big businessmen, coming to live in the States and flying into Mexico to work part of the week, and then they come back. So it's affecting many important aspects of life. And I sometimes sit on the chair of Presidente Calderón, which I sat for 6 years, but now in trying to understand what's going on, I sit on his chair and I say, well, gee, does Calderón have tranquility on his mind to think about a new program for education or a new program for infrastructure or trying to solve the problem of the oil industry? And I think that he would not have much time else but to think what he has to do today, who else has been killed today, what new surprise we'll have tomorrow. And so it's affecting daily life and it's affecting the nation, yes.
There are two different question cards here that suggest state failure. that asked the question of whether a situation in which 10,000 people have been killed since President Calderon took office, whether Mexico is headed toward that status. This other questioner asks what you make of President Obama's decision to appoint Carlos Pascal, who's an expert in state failure, as the ambassador to Mexico. I'm not sure that that's why he was appointed ambassador to Mexico, but that question has been out there.
Yeah. Okay, I would not bring in the world failure. Certainly, 3 years' experience on this strategy, it's enough to see that we need additional and different actions. We should keep this one on, the frontal fight against the cartels and against corruption, but at the same time, we have to build up other alternatives having more to do with information, with intelligence, and other measures that should be taken. But it's a cancer, and we just have to face it. Let me tell you, it goes as far back as the 20th century, where in Latin America, we did not enjoy the freedom and the democracy that has been the cornerstone of the building and the development of this nation. We spent the whole century in Latin America in hands of dictators, military dictators, personal dictators, messianic leaders, authoritarian governments, corruption, lack of transparency. The whole of the century, only until the very end, we took the steps necessary to access to democracy. And all of that is part of the story because when you don't have accountability, when you don't have transparency, when you don't have a democracy, then you build up all these situations of corruption, what we have. So the cancer has to be eliminated. It has to be eradicated. And that's what Presidente Calderon is doing. And in between, let's say it's a process that I would compare even with Iraq. When this nation decided to go into Iraq, to intervene in Iraq, everybody thought that maybe in a year's time, 6 months, maybe a year and a half, things will be solved, the dictator will be thrown out, Saddam Hussein, and democracy will come to flourish in Iraq. And it's been now, what, 5, 6 years, and still the problem is there in Iraq. So, and lives have been lost, a lot of money has been invested, but I think that's where leaders count, with their values, with their spiritual strength and determination to end up situations that don't contribute to building the kind of nation we want in Mexico. So I respect Presidente Calderon, I admire him, and he's going to win this war. Maybe he is not going to win it, but if we're consistent, maybe by next term we will win it because it's going to take some years. So no failure. I'm absolutely convinced that the right thing is being done. It's harmful, it's difficult, but we have to carry on with it.
And in fairness, this is a functioning country where services are being delivered, where elections occur, where there is some level of accountability, that we're not talking really about a failed state. We're talking about a true crisis, though, when it comes to crime and security. The Obama administration is going to supply, I think it's $80 million worth of Black Hawk helicopters, and it's going to be sending down more intelligence analysts, et cetera, to the border. And I think their focus is going to be primarily on containing the violence. Do you think that these responses are adequate?
Let me tell you, the whole amount is going to be 400 million, which we're thankful for, huh? Thank all of you. Thank all of you that are paying taxes. Same as the bailout of the $700 billion $1,000. Thanks to all of you, GM might be saved. Who knows? But it's not. I mean, it's not the answer, of course. I mean, Mexican government is inventing 1,000 times more money than that. We're investing a lot of money. It's a 50,000 army corps on a daily struggle on this. It's 300,000 police corps on a daily struggle on this. It's millions and millions of dollars being invested in trying to win this battle. It's not the money. I think the United States would contribute much more by stopping arms coming into Mexico. And that's a difficult issue in this nation. The interest of people that is in that business then, to keep free the sale of arms, so with excuse of self-defense, well, it's a good explanation, but that facilitates all this thousands of weapons going into Mexico. So that would be one great contribution. Number two, it would be, well, taking the same decision here. Why drugs are not stopped right at the border, or right after they cross the border? How come they run all throughout the United States? So reducing the traffic and the transit, as well as reducing the demand, would be a great contribution, because at the very end, it's not Mexico's fault. We just happen to be in between gorillas like Hugo Chavez, which is facilitating production, trafficking, sale of drug. And just Mexico just happens to be in between doing the job that others are not doing, and I include the United States. So a determinant action here would work pretty well for Mexico. And thirdly, understanding, because media here, well, media everywhere, it's not only power, it's a very unconscious power. I mean, the way they promote crime, the way they promote bad things, the way they do their work, and the way they have deteriorated the image of Mexico. Instead of presenting a ethical war and decision to combat cartels and drugs, they present it like a failure state, Mexican government is not doing anything. So understanding of the situation and comprehension that Mexico has to go through this to bring a solution. Let me tell you about influenza, another ethical decision of a leader. And it's a pretty difficult decision, because Presidente Calderón decided to basically stop the economy, close up restaurants and hotels and visitors to Cancun to save lives. And they said, well, it was not so dangerous, influenza. Well, we had to learn. Nobody knew how dangerous and how risky that pandemic was. In my term, we worked with U.S. health authorities long and deeply about pandemias. And we bought a million, ¿cómo se llama? Not drugs, huh? Vaccines. And we haven't kept there, but the vaccine we bought, it was for birds, not for this pandemia. But at the very end, what happened is that it's not such a, I don't know the word, but it's not so killing. It's not so, I mean, it's spreading out, and it's most everywhere in the world, but it's not so mortal, the pandemia. Now we know that. And maybe we had known that at the beginning, maybe we should not have stopped the economy. But second quarter, Mexican economy will be 10% below last year, its gross product. It's the worst performance in all of Latin America. Why? Because of the influenza decisions that had to be taken. And of course, also violence and cartels. But we are convinced Mexican economy will come back strong as soon as this economy comes back strong, which is a huge question mark whether it will come and when it will come back strong.
Let's talk more about that, because we've spoken about crime and disease. So this is, and now we're going to cheer ourselves up by talking about the economy. I'm not sure this is going to do it, but our economies are so deeply linked because of trade, because of investment, because of remittances, and because the financial systems are linked. So tell us about what the impact has been of the contraction, of this recession thus far, and what are you anticipating going forward?
Okay. Well, first, there is this convergence of negative facts, the influenza, the economic crisis, the dependence of Mexico's economy to the U.S. economy. 85% of our trading is done with the United States. 85. So whatever happens here, it has a big impact on our economy. We need U.S. economy to recover. For instance, automobile exports of Mexico, which basically are to United States, 48% down the last 2 months. So that affects jobs, that affects income, that affects exports, that affects dollar income.
Are these the auto parts for the big three?
Both Finnish automobiles and auto part industry. Mexico's a big, big supplier of automobiles to the U.S. market through the own American companies, through GM's factories in Mexico, Chrysler's, Ford's. Of course, so, there is Volkswagen's and Mercedes-Benz and BMW's. Mexico is a huge manufacturer of automobiles. And yes, that affects severely. Now, together with that, we have another problem. And I don't want to be pessimistic and show pessimism here, because we'll come along, and we have come along in the past, but we have a problem also with oil, because the oil industry in Mexico is the only one remaining as a state monopoly in the world. Nobody else has total control of government and a monopoly on energy sources but Mexico. Not even Cuba, nor China, nor Russia, nobody.
And what prevents that from being changed?
Opposition. No, there is a huge paradigm. When the oil industry was nationalized way back 1936 or 1938 by Lázaro Cárdenas, president, it became a paradigm. And nobody moves away from that. That's sacred, and it's a paradigm. We've been trying. I tried to. Calderón has been trying to change that. But we've been minority government. When we reached power in 2000, we've been minority government. Control of Congress always being in hands of the opposition. And they just have not permitted for this to change. And imagine those over $70 billion U.S. dollars that have to be invested every year in drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, in deep waters, money that we don't have, that government doesn't have. And so the wise decision should be to open the industry for private investment, not to nationalize or not to privatize, but to open to associate public and private investment, which is a magic formula that really works and works everywhere in the world. But we haven't been able to take that decision.
It's a political problem.
Basically. Again, I have to come back to this concept of young, on mature democracy just beginning. We have not been able to think as nation in our solutions, but we keep thinking partisan. And everybody pulls the rope to their own side. And we're a multi-party system, which make it much more complicated than it is a bipartisan system. We have 8 different parties competing, 3 very competitive, and up to 5 that have a strong support from people. So we have to make democracy deliver. And this is the third step in building your democracy. It's electoral democracy, then participative democracy, and then effective democracy. We have not reached that level yet in Mexico.
When the reason I'm holding on to the question of Pemex, of this government-owned company that is the energy producer, is that there are decisions that are taken that seem unwise to some, a lack of investment in infrastructure, a lack of investment in R&D, a lack of investment in other sources of energy and renewable sources of energy. What guides the decision making, and what keeps it from being perhaps as imaginative as it could be?
Well, the guide or the aspiration is yes, to have a successful nation, a successful economy, a wealth creating economy, and the powerful social policies in education, health, housing, to equal opportunities. That's the aspiration.
But I mean the decision-making of within Pemex. What guides a decision not to invest in infrastructure or exploration or more R&D?
Well,
is that a political...
Through the time, that golden cow has been milked all along, basically to survive on the budget and government revenue. The thing is that by having the oil, that instead of an angel has become a devil, because we have not done the proper and adequate fiscal reform. Mexico's total fiscal income is 11% of gross product, the lowest in all of the Americas and one of the lowest worldwide, even comparing to African nations. So because we have had the oil and the oil revenue, which makes 40% of total government revenue comes from the oil, we have not been responsible and we have not taken the decision for that fiscal reform. So we became very dependent on oil income all through the years. And Pemex has provided 40% of the funds that government is investing in infrastructure, education, and else. And at the same time, Pemex, being such a golden cow, has had the opportunity to finance, and its leverage is incredible. I mean, the debt of Pemex, it's you don't even have the right number of numbers to, it's a huge debt that has accumulated through the years. So there is no more opportunity to indebt Pemex anymore, and at the same time, it doesn't have the resources to do the investment that is needed. That's why the only source that at least I can see today is private investment associated to public investment in Pemex.
Let me turn you to a conversation about trade, because that was such an emphasis in your presidency. What is your view now of the net effect of NAFTA on Mexico?
Well, it's been great to Mexico. It's been great to the United States, and it's been great to Canada. We have built together, the three of us, the largest, by far, trade balance in the world. NAFTA, North America. Mexico has built a trade balance that is larger than all of Latin America together, including Brazil, Argentina, Colombia, Chile, and whatever, Mexico, those more trading because of NAFTA than all the rest of Latin America. Mexico by itself buys more products and services from this economy, from United States, than what Italy, France, Germany, and Britain do together. We buy from this nation over $250 billion U.S. dollars every year. That accounts for millions of jobs for U.S. citizens. So we are a solid partner of the United States and Canada. And yes, we do benefit, but also happens to be the case of United States. Even to regain the lost competitiveness, for instance, on the automobile industry, GM, Ford, Chrysler broke. They are not competitive. They cannot compete with European automobile industry, or less they can do with Asia automobile industry, and is not going to be able to ever compete with Chinese automobile industry that they are building and they are promoting. So what we need is NAFTA corporations. What we need is to nourish these NAFTA corporations that have manufacturing in Mexico, that have technology source in Canada or in the States, that have the funding in this nation, so that they nourish their competitiveness through the competitiveness of each of our three economies. So I think it's very wise to be partners and work together.
And how freely do goods move in fact? I mean, let me just sort of take back to say that after 9/11, some suggested that what we should do is come up with a North American security perimeter, a situation in which the three countries of North America would have a shared standard when it came to inspection of cargo coming in. And then once the cargo came into one country, it could move freely amongst the three. That hasn't occurred.
Yes.
So just-in-time delivery is very hard. Trucks are backed up on both of our borders. Tell us what stands in the way of that kind of solution.
Well, there are delays, but not that bad. You still can bring in raw material from most anywhere in the United States, manufacture in Mexico, and send product back the next day. That happens in most of the maquiladoras and in most of the factories in Mexico. So it still is very fluent. Even raw materials coming from Asia through the port of L.A. or through the ports of in Mexico, Lázaro Cárdenas, Manzanillo, Mazatlán, and they go directly into the maquiladora. So it's still fluent, but of course it has been affected by after September the 11th. But we both have been working on improving that flow of finished products or raw materials. So we're working on it. But at the very end, what seems to have already accomplished its objectives, but it's not generating any better today, is NAFTA. My vision is that we should build up a new vision for NAFTA. Right now, NAFTA is dormant because of President Obama with too many challenges, and is still a not very positive attitude about NAFTA, about outsourcing, about working outside of the United States. I still sense that he thinks that they lose jobs. You lose jobs here. And I read on his revolution, his book, the first book he wrote, he describes the case of Maytag Corporation, a company in the Chicago area in Illinois that had to close and had to liquidate the workers. And he claims in the book that one of those workers had a needed a kidney transplant, and because he had lost his job, he could not get his kidney transplanted, and so he died. So he presents as very emotional. Well, that company happens to be in Mexico now, and it happens to be in Guanajuato, in my hometown, in my state town, Maytag. Maytag is very successful today. Maytag had to close because it was not competitive. Same story with GM. GM has had to move to manufacture outside of the United States because cannot afford to keep paying $70 an hour to a worker of the automobile industry. I mean, cannot afford to do that and be competitive at the same time. So we're in a flat world, we're in a global world, and we all were taught to compete in that open market world. So what I see in the future is, again, the need to have a new vision for NAFTA, to further work on integration. I think the European Union is an example. Of course, that example I brought to the Governor Bush in Texas, and I brought to President Bush in Washington, and he's, no. That doesn't work here. That's for Europe. But Europe has been very successful in its integration. Look at Spain moving from $2,500 per capita income to $26,000 per capita income 25 years after. Or look at Ireland moving from $3,000 up to more than $40,000 per capita. It has the largest per capita today in Europe, Ireland, and it was a poor, teeny country not more than 25, 30 years ago. All of that is due to the union and how they work out to narrow the gap between the successful and the vanguard and those that are on the rear. And that's why I question, what would be better for United States than having a successful neighbor, than having a successful Mexican economy that can generate the jobs that Mexicans need? So it's not building walls that we're going to solve the problem. It's building bridges. It's building understanding. It's having better and new agreements to the future on NAFTA. And we can all be winners. We can all be winners through associating. Otherwise, we're losing our jobs. We're losing our competitiveness to Asia, to China, and to others.
There are other threats to the Mexican economy other than a lack of free trade, and that is that low-wage jobs are also going to China and India. What does that mean? How does Mexico respond to that problem of a rising China, rising India?
Well, let me give you some figures. For instance, border states on the Mexican side, Nuevo León, per capita income, 18,000. Chihuahua, 15,000. Coahuila, 16,000. Baja California, close to 18,000. You go to the center, to Guanajuato, where I come from, in the center of Mexico, we are on the average on 8,000 to 10,000. You go down south to Chiapas, to Yucatan, to Oaxaca, 2,500. So we go from 2,500 up to 18,000 on the north. The north is highly benefited by NAFTA. So what people is doing is moving from Chiapas, moving from Oaxaca up north, and of course from Central America. My last year of government, 250,000 Central Americans crossed the border into Mexico to come to United States. On the meantime, for a year or so, they will be working within Mexico. They reach the border, they stay there for a time, and when they can cross, they cross. So that's the effect of NAFTA on the border. So clear that it should show us that's the way to go. But we have to expand the benefits.
But wouldn't that require a deeper investment in communications and transportation infrastructure?
It needs a lot of investment, and again, let's look at Europe. The miracle of the European Union And the way they solved the situation of those lagging behind is that every nation committed to provide 2% of the gross product to this cohesiveness fund altogether. That fund amounted last year to over $100 billion. That fund, provided by everybody, the poor and the rich nations of Europe, is addressed for that purpose, to finance infrastructure, to bring in education, to construct universities, to fight poverty on the underdeveloped. So there is a specific purpose on narrowing the gap. So that's one way to go. So we don't only need performance. We need purpose. That has to be always together. We look for performance in NAFTA, but we must have purpose. And the purpose should be narrowing the gap. Because look at this Juan Perez in Laredo. He's making there, fortunately, $3 to $4 an hour. He crosses the border and he makes $12 an hour, three times more. Of course, he's always searching for the opportunity to cross the border. And when the economy is growing and healthy here, there's opportunities for everybody. So the market has been regulating the flows of migrants. This last year, I mean, migrants smell things. They know there's no jobs here. They know authorities are very tough right now, so they don't come. They're staying in Mexico. Let's not forget that not all of them, I would say the least of them, move up north because of hunger. Most of them do have income or do have a job in Mexico. It just happens to be that when you are in Guanajuato, in my hometown, and you manage to cross here, you make 8 times more, 10 times more. So kids come here, be here for 2 years, 3 years, and then they go back. And that's the opportunity they had in the past when the economy was growing. Now there is not, so they are not moving anymore. Look at this decision that a partner has taken, like Canada. I mean, they get desperate. And there is no compassion. There is no solidarity. That's why I like women, because they have that most important factor of love, compassion, vision. They are not afraid of speaking about God or religion. They're not afraid about speaking of love. And that's an ingredient that we're missing in all of our things that we do in the world. So here comes Canada, and says, no more visas for Mexicans. Wow. And this happened yesterday, before yesterday. And it's unilateral measures that, yes, we have to respect their sovereignty, it's their own decision. But why? I mean, are they going to isolate, saying that this nation is doing, building a wall? When this leading nation taught us, the rest of the world, to compete, to open our markets, to go global. We didn't want to do that. And we had to accept Coca-Cola and then hamburgers and then hot dogs. And we opened our borders and we opened our economies, but we learned the lesson and we became competitive. China became competitive, Mexico became competitive, and now we're exporting. And now that we're exporting, we say, no, wait a minute. No. Let's go back to the old times. And I don't understand this measure of Canada. I think, and I'm not in government, and I don't have that information, but I think it's because many Mexicans that are here in the States, when they're being pressed there, because of the new situation, maybe they are moving to Canada because that border is totally open. And it's totally open because of the same income on both sides. That's why we cannot have a total open border with Mexico, because the difference in income. So again, development tends to level off things and problems. And we should work as partners. That's what I think we should do.
Well, I was just trying to think of what question would provoke you to tell us why you like women. So I...
Let me tell you why, because, for instance, Marta is the most wonderful lady you have ever met.
This is Mrs. Fox.
That's my wife. I'm totally in love with her. We just got married 2 days ago by surprise, by church. Because we have married on July the 2nd of year 2001. No, 2002. Help me, Rodney. 2002. We married civil government marriage. And 2 days ago, we married by the church because we were waiting for our annulation of the our former, And well, but that's among other things where I like Martha. She's back there working. I'm here enjoying. No, really. Believe me. Look, in Central Fox, and let me a brief commercial here. We built our own presidential library for the first time ever outside of the United States. It's built at the ranch in Central Fox, in Rancho San Cristobal, where my grandfather came from Cincinnati, Ohio, as a migrant back in 1895. And he settled in Guanajuato, and he found his American dream, which is the dream of the Americas. It's not only American dream. It's the dream of all of us in this continent. So he came in, he settled there, and he did well. He found his dream. Well, right there, we built the library. And we work on democracy and freedom. We work on market economy with responsibility. We work on developing powerful social policies on education, health, and else. And we work on gender equity because of Martha's passion and my own commitment with the subject. And it's because in Latin America, in the 20th century, we did not only lack democracy and freedom on being in the hands of dictators, but women were relegated to the kitchen. And that's where we missed the ball. That's where we didn't have the dynamics that you have in the societies. And so integrating women to leading and to meeting the challenges of the 21st century, to me, is a must in Latin America. And we have to do it as soon as possible. And that's why we have taken this challenge in Central Fox, because our belief is that we are all leaders. Your leader, your leader, your leader. She is a leader. We are all leaders all the time of our life. And the problem is many of us do not go within ourselves, do not discover our leadership, and do not commit it or implement it. And that's what we do in Central Fox, to assist, to facilitate every person to discover its leadership and commit it with a good cause.
And this is Central Fox is very much modeled on the idea of a presidential library, but an activist one, one that is a think tank, a place where you can have exchanges with universities. Since you got to work in that advertisement, I am going to work in some of the questions that came from the floor. One came from a Mexican-American who said, for those of us who have left the country but still love the country, those of us in economic exile, how can we help the current situation in Mexico? And another questioner asks, notes that you grew the middle class when you were president, and worries very much that the middle class is shrinking now as a result of the global recession, and wanted you to comment on that.
Yeah. Our paisanos here and all these wonderful people that is here in the United States and everywhere else in the world, we have many, many Mexicans that are in China working. and looking for a better life. We have them in Brazil, in Chile, everywhere. So Mexicans, as Americans, many of us like to move out and look for opportunities elsewhere. And we have over 100,000 U.S. citizens working in Mexico. So, again, it's this world that we live today that offers and provides those opportunities. Now, the people that is here, number one, I have to thank each and every one of them because they think of their families and they make these money transferences that account for over $22 billion U.S. dollars. And it's really a great support to their families. And it used to be for expense. Today, most of that money is being saved or capitalized in small businesses and small ventures. So I think there will happen what happened with Ireland, that Ireland started bringing back money from all the Irish people spread out in the world, basically here in the United States. And that's what gave them the capacity to capitalize and grow their nation. So that's happening in Mexico. And but it's very sad that the talent that we have that comes to U.S. universities, most of the time they stay here. And they stay here because they have the opportunities here. Maybe they would have to struggle more in Mexico. And so they don't go back right when they're finished their study. So we're losing a lot of talent also because of this. It's a vicious circle. We have to build up a virtuous circle. And basically, we have to be successful in the economy. I don't want to be arrogant. I don't want to, como se dice, ser soberbio. Okay. But in my term, together with President Zedillo's term, in 10 years, we moved from 3,500 U.S. dollars income to 8,500. We reduced debt to half of what it was. We increased reserves to double than what they were. He who invested in Mexico $1 on the 1st of December of year 2000, he had $3.50 on the 1st of December of 2006. 350%. The stock exchange in Mexico had the best performance compared to any other stock exchange in the world. And we reduced poverty, as I said, by 35%. So it can be done. And what we need is consistency. And what we need is to stay on the path and really make sure that public policies remain in effect for a long time and not to be changed when government is changed. And that's exactly what we are doing in Mexico. Very unfortunately, this mammoth, this gargantuan crisis started here in the United States because of the excesses of consumption, because of the excesses of multiplying credit and finances to more than was good. And so we were paying the price because of that. But at the same time, I can tell you that as well as Mexico recovered from that mammoth crisis back in 1994, and countries in Latin America did the same, that will happen here. Still, I see a lot of pessimism whether this will be overcome or not. I'm absolutely convinced that this world is full of talent everywhere and leadership everywhere, especially this nation. And you see many, many of those talents working on how to overcome the crisis and how to come back to growth that we all need. And I'm sure that will happen. And in the case of Mexico, those who are doing worst right now, it's like a balloon that you bring under the water and you let it free and jumps back again. I'm sure the next year or two, the world economy will come back to growth and we all benefit from that.
You were succeeded by another PAN leader, by Felipe Calderón. But the PRI seems to have had a resurgence in these last elections, these July elections. Is this because that party has refreshed and rethought its strategy, meaning it's the content of its policies, or is this because of circumstances changing, of the global economy and other factors?
Yeah. No, I guess there are different reasons for that. Number one, what we all learned here back in the times of Carville and President Clinton campaigning, when he told me, is the economy stupid? Address the issue, consumers, citizens, first preoccupation and worry is the economy, is the income in their pockets. And it's pretty difficult for a party in government to succeed one election when the economy is as bad as it is today in Mexico in this moment. So that's maybe the key factor. Plus, that the strategy of my party, and I had to do with it, but against the decision they took, is that they addressed the strategy, the communication strategy, to cartels and to reinforce Presidente Calderón's position. He enjoys a beautiful acceptance and approval from citizens. Calderón remains on the 65-70% approval now in his third year. But it's basically because of that, because he's considered a hero, that he's giving this fight and this war against crime, against cartels, and against corruption. But that has not been transferred to the party. And the party made the mistake of concentrating the campaign on the war on drugs and traffic. And at the very end, that for people is not their best priority. It is income, it's their job. So we missed it there. And that had to do a lot with the final result.
There are two more questions, and I think we probably only have time for these two more, that relate to the region more broadly. You made reference to Chavez earlier, Hugo Chavez earlier.
Say something. Gorilla, I
said. Yes, say it. Say more.
Huh?
Say more.
Say more.
You were not a fan of his when you were in office.
It's incredible. It's story repeating itself. I don't know who remembers Fidel Castro, but his first years and months coming to power, it was a hero. Everybody was excited, even United States, and we all thought he was going to be the great leader because he finished a dictatorship. He threw out the dictator. So everybody thought that better times would come. No. It was attrition to democracy and ended up as a worst tyrant and as a worst dictator than the former Batista. With Chavez happened the same. I remember on my inauguration day, he came to the inauguration day and we had a meeting. The three of us that conformed this trade agreement called G3, which is Venezuela, Colombia, and Mexico. And at that time, there was a conflict between Colombia and Venezuela because of a border problem in their border. So they were in conflict. So we sat together, we spoke, and I tried to arbitrage their differences, and we came with an agreement to correct the conflict. And it was a guy that you could speak to. He was very democratic right after he finished his election. He used to sing like Pedro Infante, the best Mexican songs, he would sing them to you. But he started liking power. He started becoming the dictator, and now he's there, and he is planning to be there forever until he dies. So there are many using democracy to hide their aspirations of messianic control of power. And this takes me to the Honduras right now. Of course, the way it happened is totally anti-democratic, and the legitimate elected president should be recognized again and back again. But there is an order of the Supreme Court of Honduras before he was taken out of the presidency stating that he could not violate the Constitution to putting together a referendum on changing the Constitution to his own personal benefit. And he was advised on that. He knew what he was doing. And even though he carried on with it. Now, the other reason is, why now we respond so quickly, everybody, including United States, my country, in blaming, in putting the default on those who threw him out, when the other side of the story was not listened before. And there is a conflict between legal rule of law and the Constitution and the way he was thrown out of power. But more so, what I understand is people, business community, professionals that have seen and witnessed the story of Venezuela and how it has gone. And here, with the intervention of Hugo Chavez, this guy, Manuel, the president exiled, started with the same story. Changed the Constitution to be reelected, to stay in power, president. So people say, we have to do something. And that's what occurred to them to do. I know it's non-democratic, but at the same time it's non-democratic. When you have a two-term re-election to change the Constitution and go for the third and the fourth, that's not democracy and consistency with democracy. By the way, I don't agree with my very close friend, which I admire and I respect, President Uribe in Colombia. The idea of changing the Constitution to go for the third term, I don't think he should do that. It's just my personal opinion. Because, again, then we're moving on the same direction on both sides. So it's a very complicated, this case of Honduras. I don't know how it's going to be solved. It's very, very complicated.
That was going to be a question, because two of the question cards were about Honduras and asking about the status of the mediations that Oscar Arias has been involved in, President Arias. But also, I'd like to sort of throw in the question of what is the expectation of the Obama administration in this? Because some have called upon the United States to get engaged. And what is your advice to the Obama administration, given that it wants to be a collaborative leader, not a dominant force in the region?
Of course, it's like the pendulum. No doubt that a deep correction had to be done on the position of the United States throughout the world. And because the leadership of the United States was being harmed and severely harmed because of these interventions. So, yes, there's a change needed in foreign policy, moving from military to democratic, moving to from imposing to dialogue. And yes, we're all expecting that to happen in the region. On the other extreme, you have people like I heard from President Aznar from Spain. He says, well, the day you begin to be open and to be negotiating mind and to be light in your discussions and trying not to provoke conflict, these guerrillas and these governments like the ones you find in the Middle East or in Iraq or in Iran, they get over you. And so it's a blend. It's like when you are on your horse. You have to be very delicate in the way you are firm and impose order, and the way you're open, dialogue, and you negotiate. And it's going to be very difficult, that blend, the proper blend for the administration, because many will tend to take advantage, thinking that now there is a president for dialogue that is weak and that he is permissible. And so the bad guys will take advantage of that. It's very complicated. I wish the best to President Obama. Fortunately, he got the best on Hillary Clinton as head of the State Department. And I think she's going to do a great job.
I can see there's a consistency here.
I think she's going to do a great job.
Please join me in thanking President Fox.